Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
President Biden reaches for emergency powers to mitigate AI risks.
In general, companies are going to resist anything that they think would slow down their ability to keep up with competitors, even if they are indeed worried about some of these bigger risks from new models that are going to be coming out.
Plus, the UAW expands its strike against GM while making a deal with Stellantis. And we'll examine the risk that Hezbollah opens up a new front in Israel's war against Hamas. It's Monday, October 30th. I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal, and here is the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. Israeli soldiers have extended their push into the Gaza Strip following a weekend of continued bombardment. The U.S. and other Western countries have stressed the need to minimize civilian casualties, with President Biden underscoring the need to increase the flow of humanitarian aid to Gaza in a call yesterday with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Meanwhile, the specter of another front continues to worry governments in the region as Hezbollah and the Israeli army exchanged fire across Lebanon's border throughout the weekend. But what is the actual likelihood of Hezbollah entering the Israeli-Hamas war and escalating it into a regional crisis? Hanin Gadar is a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. She is an expert on Shia politics and has written extensively on Hezbollah. Hanin, tell us, what calculations is Hezbollah likely to be weighing now, deciding whether to expand this war to Israel's northern border or not?
Well, this is the main question for Lebanon today, right? I think Hezbollah's calculations are really Iran's calculations. And for the Iranian regime, so far, they have made a few achievements from the Gaza war. They have shifted the regional attention to the Iranian proxies to the region. They have halted, at least for now, the Saudi-Israeli peace deal. And they have turned everyone in the region back to the Palestinian issue, which is the core of what the Iranian regime's and their proxies' narrative is in Lebanon. So the main thing that they're doing today is trying to translate these little gains into political achievements in the region. Everyone was going into a different direction economically, diplomatically, and now everyone is looking back at Iran, who thinks that they are regained their seat back at the table.
And how does the arrival of U.S. military assets in the region potentially affect those calculations?
I think Hamas made a miscalculation when they thought that the number of hostages they took back into Gaza will hinder Israel. And I think Hezbollah and Iran also miscalculated the American response. I follow their internal dialogues, internal discussions. The narrative at the beginning of the war was more about, we are getting there. We are joining. Be ready. They evacuated people from the south of Lebanon. Everything was showing that they are going there and they're getting ready for war. And then the Americans arrived. And slowly but surely, that narrative started to shift in the sense that we decide when. This is not the good time. There are different red lines that need to be crossed first. They don't want to get into a war with Israel, but they definitely do not want to engage in a war with America.
Now that Israel has begun, it seems, its ground invasion of Gaza, how much will that impact Hezbollah's decision-making about whether to escalate here?
Yes, that's a very good question. It's portrayed as the red line. Their calculations today lie in the fact that their power is precision missile weapons. They have reportedly a few dozen of these precision-guided weapons. And these weapons are very hard and expensive to make. And they know that the threat of these weapons are much more valuable and effective than the weapons themselves, because the minute they use them, they will lose them. Imagine afterwards. What is Iran going to do? How are they going to restock Hezbollah with these weapons? It could take many years. They'll be exposed, and they do not have the budget or the military commandment for this war.
And were we to see a shift in calculation by Hezbollah or by Iran that escalation is necessary or worth the risk, is there anything the Lebanese state can do to stop that from happening, from this turning into a regional war?
Well, every day the risk of miscalculation and mistakes is growing. The margin is unbelievably scary because everybody's on edge, and a wrong target, a small miscalculation, could open the region to a war that no one wants. So let's say that it happens despite the fact that they are trying to avoid it. The Lebanese state has zero impact. Despite the fact that Hezbollah lost the majority of the parliament in 2022 elections, they still have the arms and they control Lebanon with these arms. And this is going to change the face of the country, and they can't do anything about it.
Hanin Gadar is a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Hanin, thank you so much for being with us on What's News.
Thank you very much. It's really my pleasure.
Coming up, President Biden is looking to mitigate AI risks by turning to emergency federal powers. Plus, another turbulent weekend for U.S. auto strikes. We've got those stories and more after the break.
Technology can make the world better. At UST, we're building a future where people everywhere are empowered to live better lives.
It's transformation you can feel.
And you don't have to do it alone.
We believe in the power of technology to transform businesses and build a better world.
President Biden is turning to emergency federal powers in order to rein in the risk of artificial intelligence. According to the White House, Biden will invoke the Korean War era Defense Production Act today in order to force major AI companies to let the government know if they're building systems that could pose a range of risks from national security to public health, and would direct them to use AI to find and fix vulnerabilities in software. There is a lot in this executive order, and Journal tech reporter Sam Schechner is here to break it down for us. Sam, there are a number of key details on this that are still to come, but from what we've seen, this does seem like the administration's first big attempt to formally step into the regulatory vacuum around AI, no?
Indeed, the Biden administration has made a big public stand that they want the U.S. to start regulating AI, and they're not going to wait for Congress to do it. Back in July, the White House invited top AI companies to a meeting to discuss the issue. And out of that meeting, there were some voluntary commitments along the lines in some ways of what the companies were already doing. But even back then, there was the promise of an executive order that was coming that would add some teeth, that would invoke regulatory powers to force the companies to do certain things aimed at bolstering national security or reducing the risks of some of these tools.
Sam, we have yet to hear from the big tech companies about what they make of this executive order, but given what their executives have said in the past, including at a visit to Capitol Hill last month to talk about potential AI regulation, what do we imagine their response to this order might be?
Well, the companies have said, hey, we think this area should be regulated. At least these big companies have. Cynics have said, sure, the big companies that have a lead in this technology want regulation. It'll slow everyone down and keep their positions intact. Others would say, hey, listen, they have the same interest as the rest of us in making sure that runaway AI doesn't lead to some doomsday scenarios that have been floated. Being required, for instance, to tell the Commerce Department how they're working to protect their technology from malicious use is something along the lines of what, say, the EU is going to require for them. That's an auditing style requirement that might be something that they would accept. Now, notifying the government within 90 days of when a foreigner uses their services to train a large AI system, maybe that would be seen as more invasive.
You mentioned the European Union a moment ago. This is also coming amid a time of strong AI competition with China. Given what we've seen so far, how do these proposals compare to how Beijing is treating AI as a key area of national security and interest?
There are some similarities. China was actually pretty fast this year, following the release of some of these new generative models like ChatGPT, to start to issue regulations around deepfakes or around how these tools could be used. They put rules in place that required government approval for the release of certain types of AI models after a security review. Now, their goals might be different. Some of what they're seeking to verify is that the AI tools won't output content that undermines state authority. That is presumably not along the lines of what the Biden administration is seeking. But the idea that these countries are trying to get a handle on these tools and to make sure that they operate within the cultural and political norms of their systems is something that we see China, we see the US and the EU and also the UK and other parts of the world trying to do.
I have been speaking to Journal tech reporter Sam Schechner. Sam, thank you so much.
Of course.
The U.S. and China are moving closer to holding a summit between President Biden and Xi Jinping next month. China's foreign minister wrapped up a visit to Washington over the weekend, having secured an agreement in principle about the summit, according to an American official. A Chinese statement noted that both sides believed it necessary to maintain dialogue, though acknowledged that many issues still need to be resolved. A Xi-Biden meeting, likely on the sidelines of an APEC summit in San Francisco, would offer a chance to reboot ties amid divisions over Taiwan, technology, and lately, the Middle East. It was a stop-and-start weekend for U.S. auto strikes. On Saturday, the United Auto Workers reached a tentative labor deal with Chrysler parent Stellantis, a largely similar agreement to one that was tentatively struck with Ford days earlier. But in the latest in a string of unexpected moves by the union, it called for a fresh strike at General Motors. Journal Auto's reporter Nora Eckert says the surprise UAW walkout at a factory in Tennessee followed several days of talks between GM and union leaders, after which both sides said they were disappointed the other declined to finalize a deal.
Just before this weekend, Stellantis and GM were seen as sort of neck and neck and being the next to reach a tentative agreement. We thought we might see a GM deal by Sunday evening. We have not. And the union is trying to use this accelerated, expanded strike to push GM over to the finish line. But the talks haven't hit a standstill by any means. We're still seeing this as GM being close to reaching a deal. We've seen time and time again, these talks are very fluid and the situation can change very quickly.
One motivator for GM to wrap things up, the cost of ongoing strikes, with the company saying last week that each additional week of walkouts is costing it $200 million in lost profit. Shares in China Evergrande have fallen to a fresh low after the company got another chance to restructure its billions of dollars in debt. A Hong Kong high court today adjourned a hearing to liquidate the property giant and instead set a new date for December 4th. But as Asia Finance reporter Rebecca Fung told us, Evergrande has a $300 billion debt mountain to climb.
Evergrande is a company with $332 billion of liabilities by the end of June. And to be frank, it's just got a lot of problems it needs to solve before we can say that it's saved. For example, it still owes money to a bunch of suppliers, has a lot of unfinished projects. And as the restructuring process went along, actually, we discovered more and more sort of undisclosed financial obligations. This restructuring plan preliminarily was, well, mapped out in March, and it was pulled back quite suddenly by the end of September. So it's a month of delay, but not sure if there are more surprises, negative and positive ones, that could come out of it.
Now to earnings and global banking giant HSBC, whose net profit more than doubled in the third quarter as high interest rates continue to bolster bank earnings. Profits at the company increased to about $5.6 billion in the 3 months through September, with it also announcing a $3 billion share buyback, its fourth this year alone. And Americans are increasingly being paid for not doing work. A growing gap is appearing between hours paid and hours worked as employers expand paid benefits such as vacation and sick leave amid a strong labor market. Journal reporter Jeff Sparshot says those increased benefits offer a way for employers to differentiate themselves as they look to retain and attract new employees.
Paid leave is something an employer can offer that might not have the same immediate cost as higher wages or a bonus. It can also boost morale and help employee retention. Reducing turnover is important for a lot of companies. And it also means that employers have to get better at scheduling, and either businesses have to become more productive or they're going to need more people to make up for the lost hours. If it's the latter, that could make a tight job market even tighter.
And that is What's News for Monday morning. Today's show was produced by Kate Bullivant. Our supervising producer is Sandra Kilhoff, and I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal. We will be back tonight with a new show. Until then, thanks for listening.